I'm sitting quietly. Become completely relaxed in this place and this time. It's okay to be at ease. It's okay to not want anything. It's okay to not feel any lack. Here is here, now is now. This is enough. This is all we have. And the mind starts to think about this and that. Just note that thinking. Thinking. Cutting through the stream of thought. Being still and at peace. Just watching. Noticing the mood, the emotion that's carrying through to the meditation. Jealousy, frustration, restlessness, contentment, confusion, whatever it is, just watch it, being aware, not getting too involved with it. Focused in the heart. And bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. This old friend thought bringing it in with care, with attention, evenly, smoothly. Evoking that pure, sustained, wholesome wish for your own true happiness and well-being. and then noticing underneath the words of metta is something deeper, something more subtle. It's the feeling of metta. Radiant glow, soft and joyous. And the loving kindness wells up in the heart, spills over, fills up your whole body. And then taking that same metta and spreading it out to the whole room. May all the people in this room be happy. May all the people in this room be happy. May all the people in this room be happy. And coming back to oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, allowing the mind to return to neutral space, empty, open and clear. and the mind is clear and relax, then just take a minute to review over how that meditation's gone, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did I apply the meditation object? How did the course of meditation unfold? What happened at the different stages of the meditation? How is my mind like now compared with how it was at the start of the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu. As we feel the heat, on an afternoon like today, one of the hottest days of the year, the method of Satipatthana meditation asks us to contemplate or be aware of this element of heat. This external property, property of nature, property of the physical realm. And that property is the same as the heat element we feel inside us. When the evening draws in, sun disappears, then the heat of the day will dissipate. The heat element will change. State of profound emotional dependence on these changes. Normally we only notice it in little things. We notice if we feel discomfort on a hot day. We notice it if we feel cold on a cold night. So when it approaches the extremes, our attention is drawn to it. Or we try to control it when we're cooking food. The hot food has to be hot, the cold food has to be cold. Putting in the heat element or taking it out gives us pleasure. Or it gives us suffering if we do it the wrong way. What's hot should be cold, or what's cold should be hot. In fact, our bodies can only exist in a very narrow range of temperatures. If we start going outside of that even a little bit, then we die very quickly. In the heat of the stars, the temperature is millions of degrees. In the coldness of space, it approaches absolute zero. And in between those two extremes, there's a tiny little band of temperatures that we can survive at. It's called in physics, they call it the Goldilocks effect. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. this physical property of the heat element. Which we tend not to give too much thought to. When it gets out of balance, something goes wrong with it then. Maybe it's all we think of. We're trapped somewhere in the snow and the freezing cold. Or if we're in the blazing desert in the heat of the day. And constant shifts and adjustments that we have to make to keep the heat element of the body comfortable, to keep it as we want it. Temperature drops a few degrees, we start to put jumpers on, start to rug up. Gets a few degrees warmer, we want to shed our layers, find a place with some shade and a nice breeze. The heat element itself is the agent of change. According to Indian philosophy, the heat element is the element of aging. And of course that's pretty much true. We know that. We want to preserve something longer, we put it in the fridge. Yeah? We leave something out on a hot day, it goes bad very quickly. So on the one hand it's the energy of life, so we know when the body goes cold that it's dead, but also is also the energy of aging. So at once is the agent of life and the agent of aging at the same time. So one of the things which Satipatthana meditation calls us to do is to focus bring our awareness to these very fundamental aspects of our experience. Things which normally escape our attention. Not because they're far away, but because they're all too close. Like the fish that doesn't know what water is because it doesn't know anything else. We don't see or we don't understand these elements. because they constitute the very fabric of our experience in every moment. As we sit here, we can feel all of the elements operating. The earth element is here in terms of the hardness, the rigidity, the stiffness of our seat, our back, and bones. So we draw attention to the solid aspect of our experience, the heaviness of it, the ground feeling. And we notice that aspect of resistance of unyielding physicality, something we feel in ourselves. We also feel outside ourselves. We feel that in the external object that we come into contact with. But even more than that, we actually feel or we experience in the boundary between those two things. So it's when the hardness of the body presses up against the hardness of our seat, that's when you feel both of those hardnesses. We actually only experience the internal and external elements, even though we in a sense isolate them or can focus on them in some sense individually, but in another sense we can only focus on one or the other in contrast with each other. It's the same with temperature, like we feel hot or cold, but actually feelings of hot or cold really are just feelings relative to the temperature of our body. So the idea that there is an internal and an external is really an abstraction. It's part of experience in a contingent way, in a conditional way. But the more we go into it, the deeper we sink our awareness into these things, and the less it seems that distinction between inner and outer makes any sense. Eventually it just vanishes away. And we also experience the water element. Sitting here, the heat element probably a bit excessive for most of us. So it causes a shortage of the water element in our mouths, we get thirsty. And an excess of the water element on our skin, we sweat. Idea that the internal water element and the external water element, you know, closely related of course, is very true from a physical point of view, that the sweat and the blood inside the body is comprised of very similar proportions of chemicals that we find in the ocean as a whole. Sweat that leaks out of our body doesn't just disappear, it evaporates, it goes into the atmosphere, it rises up as vapor, eventually becomes part of a cloud, and eventually it rains, fills up the ocean again. Or maybe it rains, fills up the dam, and becomes drinking water, we drink it again. So this idea of the breaking down of the inner and the outer elements is not just a kind of an idea, but it's actually a very powerful contemplation. Normally the preservation of that distinction is crucial to our sense of identity. I am this lump of meat. I'm not that lump of meat. These are my fluids. The experience of my body in a way that's very intimate. And we don't have any secrets from our own body. We know what it's like when we go to the toilet, when we have a shower. We know what it's like when our body's dirty and smelly. We know what it's like when it's clean and fresh. We know what it's like when it's sick. You know what it's like when it's healthy. It goes through all these changes and all these cycles. And it's always an issue, isn't it, when things transgress this boundary between the inner and the outer. For example, when we eat food, then that's an important issue for us. We need to know that the food is clean, that it's fresh, it's not going to poison us. It's got to be nutritious, it's got to be the right kind of food that we can digest. All of these things. And similarly, when we shed bits of our body, not just when we put them in, but when we shed them, it's important to us. It's a kind of a sign of our health or our sense of who we are. So this practice of contemplating the elements, which sounds very simple actually when we get into it, the more we get into it, the more challenging we realize that it is. One of the subtle of the elements. The breath coming in and out of the body. In a sense, it's very transient. We own the breath for a much shorter time than we own our body's heat or solid parts or liquids, only for a couple of seconds. The air is out there, we breathe it in for a couple of seconds, it belongs to us, it's in our lungs. The lungs hard at work extracting the oxygen and all the good bits out of the air, and then all too soon it's breathed out again. It takes out the carbon dioxide. Hardly can be considered ours, can it? Just that few seconds. And yet, just a few minutes without the breath, and we're finished. Actually, all of these elements we're dependent on. We don't get the food. The earth element in the food, and then we die. If we don't get something to drink, we die. We don't have the heat, we don't maintain the heat within a close parameter, then we die. If we don't breathe for a few minutes, we die. So this is one of the reasons why these things are always considered to be gods. If we look at the pantheon in ancient India or ancient Greece and many other places, you know, all of these things are personified as gods. Agni is a fire god. And Poseidon, the various kind of ocean gods and river gods and goddesses and so on. Vayu, the wind. And the various kinds of earth goddesses. So this is a kind of a way of by considering these things as a divinity, this is a way of representing or expressing a sense of awe. A sense of mixed, there's always this kind of sense of awe, has a mixed like devotion and gratitude on one hand, and then fear on the other hand, which is quite a realistic attitude to take. because these are in fact things which a mighty incomprehensible forces of nature which are bringers of both great good and of great evil. And so it's all too understandable why they would be treated in that way. And so in Buddhism, the elements are not, obviously not deified in any sense, but they still retain that sense of ambiguity about them. Contemplation, the depth of understanding of the elements has a certain kind of ambiguity to it. On the one hand, they are something which can bring destruction. The contemplations of, for example, what happens when the water element disappears. And we read these very vivid descriptions in the suttas where the oceans recede further and further down until there's just a couple of inches of water left in the ocean. And all the lakes have disappeared, and there's no water at all to drink. Or when the fire comes, burns up the whole world. And these kinds of apocalyptic visions, of course, quite accurate descriptions of the actual fate of the planet Earth will actually reach a time when all the oceans have dried up. Will actually reach a time when the Earth is completely burnt and incinerated. And so on this macro scale, the law of impermanence applies in a grand way. And if this whole earth can be deprived of water, it can be destroyed through fire, how much more so this little fragile body of ours? So of course this kind of contemplation which the Buddha gave which must have been quite difficult to imagine in the Buddha's time. If we place ourselves in the Buddha's time in the Ganges Valley, you know, you have say this huge forest all around you. You have this kind of massive jungle that stretches for hundreds of miles in every direction. Little kind of carved out bits of human settlement here and there with tenuous and dangerous roads linking them. And there are only a few small cities in this massive jungle. And it's, you know, quite audacious to say that, you know, all of that jungle can go and disappear. Must have seemed quite extraordinary, quite a very clearly bold thing to say. And yet, of course, that's what we've seen in that time since then. We've seen precisely that, and the jungle has disappeared. You go to that same land today and you hardly find any jungle anywhere. Just a few little vestiges in the most difficult to access hills and mountains and things. and the reality of this kind of world destruction. It's not just a kind of a cyclic myth to contemplate as something which happens inevitably at the end of the era, but it's something for us which we may well, as humans, bring about ourselves at any time. And which could come about in any or all of the ways that the Buddha talked about. So this is the, if you like, the danger of the elements when we're contemplating them, contemplate the impermanence of them, the tenuousness of the structure, and life is manifested through an incredibly complex interweaving of these fantastically subtle organizational structures. The physical structures and the biological structures and the DNA and the cells and all of the bits that go up to them, and then the incredible structures in the brain and the mind and so on. And there's this kind of this loosely woven, very flexible and very contingent kind of sense of order about what we are. But that chaos threatens that. The leakages out from the body are like the breaking down into chaos, the incursion of lower orders of structure into our body. The quick and easy undoing of an achievement of order which has taken so many millions of years of evolution and which has been actively maintained by us every day. There's also this kind of terrifying aspect of the elements. There's also a more gentle aspect to them as well. And it's not so frequently emphasized that the Buddha taught the contemplation of these elements also as a as closely related to metta practice. And so while the contemporary proponents of Satipatthana meditation like to make a nice clear distinction between the wisdom practices of contemplating impermanence and the concentration practices, in the suttas we find that things are not so clear-cut, not so categorical. The establishing of the focus of awareness with the four elements opens a window into the mind. From where we can look in different directions. We can see different things through that window. We can step through that door, go different paths. So the Buddha talked about how to overcome anger, one of the means of overcoming anger. When we look at this body, made up of earth, we look at the bodies of others, also made up of earth. What's the difference? Well, not much. The main difference is that I call this bit mine. And I'm attached to it. Asked us to contemplate what happens to the earth, what happens when people throw rubbish on the ground, when people burn the earth. Is the earth upset by that? Does the earth feel anger? Does the earth want to get revenge? So the Buddha said to make your mind as broad as the earth. Broad and as vast, as solid as this great earth. That's a calling, isn't it? It's a challenge. When we're being asked to contemplate that way, we're being asked to come out of our pettiness. We're being asked to transcend our limited individual self. We're being asked to become part of that reality which we are normally alienated from. So the Buddha said, with someone with mind developed in metta, even if someone was to go around and try to destroy the earth, take a hammer and smash it, piss on it, throw crap down on the ground, burn it, I'm going to kill you, earth. What can they do? Can they destroy the earth? What are those acts of that one man in comparison with the vastness of this great earth? That's how big we should make our hearts. As wide as the ocean. Someone comes along with a bucket, says, right, I'm going to empty the ocean. And it says in the sutta, what would they reap but weariness and disappointment? Make our minds as big as the sky. Make your mind as big as the sky. Meditations they take us into a different sphere. Literally, they will expand our consciousness. We're so concerned with our little world, our likes and dislikes, our preferences, and kind of petty grudges that we have, and inane stream of self-righteousness and criticism of others. All this shit that we shovel into our minds. All the folly and stupidity. It makes us act like I matter. We should be reminding ourselves of these things again and again and again. Learn to broaden and expand the mind in meditation. Take it from little to big. Sit outside your kuti, pick up a grain of sand. One grain of sand on the end of your fingertip. Look at that grain of sand. Hold it there, feel it between your fingers. Look at it. Contemplate it. Look at it from different sides. One grain of sand. One leaf. Pick up one leaf and look at that. And then a handful. A handful of sand or a handful of leaves. A few meters on it, what you can see on the ground when you look in front of you. And then look out, look bigger than that. Look around as far as you can see. Go to the cliff, look out over the cliff, look out over the forest. See how far you can see there. Imagine that going forever. Right round this whole sphere of the planet Earth. And then this planet being just a tiny, tiny little speck in the galaxy. And our galaxy being just one of countless millions of other galaxies. And our universe being just one of countless universes spread out in time and space. And come back little bit by little bit to one grain of sand. And that grain of sand is the whole universe. In that one drop of water. So this is just the power of awareness. What do we choose to bring into our minds? What do we choose to focus on? Do we choose to focus on those things that are skillful or focus on those things that are unskillful? How do those different ways of using the mind affect how our awareness is? And how does, inversely, the quality of our awareness shift those things of which we are aware? Meditation, as part of our Satipatthana practice, this is part of it. One aspect of it is that aspect of mindful awareness. Just knowing, just watching. This is part of it. But the aspect of just watching or just knowing, while a very important and essential aspect of all meditation practice, is itself also subtly delusory. And there's no doubt that needs to be a part of our meditation practice. But the idea that it's the whole of our meditation practice is actually, as a remark that Venerable Dhammika once made to me, is that it's actually more derived from Krishnamurti than it is from authentic Buddhist sources. Krishnamurti used this phrase, choiceless awareness. And in that phrase is encapsulated the delusion about the mind, which I believe that Krishnamurti never got beyond. There is no such thing as choiceless awareness. It's just a delusion. Choice is always involved. We are always directing the mind. If we think that awareness is choiceless, that's because we're not being aware of how our inner drives, our inner motivations, our inner emotions are shaping the way that we choose to focus our awareness. And so in Buddhist meditation, we don't just do that's practice. So this is why I prefer to say mindful awareness rather than choiceless awareness. Mindful awareness. We don't just do that kind of practice, but we also do practices where we manipulate our awareness. We shift the focus of our awareness consciously. Whether we're doing that in metta meditation, we shift the metta through the body. Then we and we develop metta for the different persons in metta meditation. Or whether it be in anapana meditation where we reject the thoughts and sounds and sensations of the body and focus just on the feeling of the breath. Or whether it be elements meditation where we focus carefully on different aspects of physical experience and where we practice with expanding and contracting those, focusing on them in different ways. And there's quite a lot about this in the suttas, and also in the Visuddhimagga is a great source of ideas for elements contemplation. There's a tremendous chapter on elements meditation in the Visuddhimagga, and a lot of great advice there, great ideas for how to go about it. And in that directed or kind of managed shifting of the focus of awareness, you begin to see, you begin to understand how we are constantly shaping awareness. Even when we think that it's choiceless awareness, we think that it's bare awareness. Actually, it's never bare awareness. Awareness can only happen as part of a constellation, complex constellation of qualities. And
so we play around with those things, we play around with shifting the focus, expanding, contracting, moving it through the body internally and externally. All of these different ways of playing with it. Visual experience, tactile experience, mental experience. Letting these things all kind of feed into the meditation. Using as many different ways as we can to approach the same question, different angles on the same problem. We realize that everything has its angle. It's the nature of consciousness itself. That's what the Buddha meant when he said that consciousness is conditioned by nama rupa. Consciousness is conditioned by nama rupa. That means that our experience of the specificness of experience, of concepts, of appearance, of physical properties, appearance of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, these things which are conceptually processed, categorized, understood in the mind. These make possible the working of consciousness. The idea that we can let go of all of these individual specific things and have like a pure or bare awareness, consciousness which is devoid of what they call akara. Yogacara philosophy, they call akara, I see. Or in the Yoga Sutra, particularities it's not possible. We can reduce them, we reduce the multiplicity of the world, we simplify consciousness, we take it to a place where the manifestation of those particularities of the world, what they call in Taoism, they call the 10,000 things, where they largely disappear and we're just left with the very kind of subtle objects of meditation. But this is not supposed to teach us that, you know, we get rid of all of these things, we just have an objectless consciousness. On the contrary, these things are showing us when we investigate them that the consciousness is always conditioned by nama rupa. So while the basic list of the elements, the four elements I've been talking about this evening, is of course the basic physical properties of the world, it corresponds with the states of matter that we were taught about in high school physics, solid, liquid and gas, and heat being the element which changes matter from one of those states to the other. But in the extended lists of the elements, of course, it includes the element of space. Space being something which doesn't so much exist by itself, but which is conditioned by the absence of the other elements. Space being just a word that we use to describe the non-appearance of other elements. And the last element, of course, is jnana dhatu, the element of consciousness. And so our contemplation of these elements, our contemplation of these physical properties, as it were, goes through into consciousness, it goes through into the mind. And we realize, we apprehend how the very manifestation, the very existence of these elements is only within consciousness. Outside of consciousness, there's nothing. So by delimiting and exploring these elements, our emotional engagement with them, involvement with them, their manifestations in different forms, internal and external, they're changing from evolving over periods of time, short periods of time, long periods of time, the elements on the micro scale and the macro scale. In all of these things we are learning the possibilities of consciousness. The possibility for our mind to conceive of these things. And the unfathomably mysterious nature of consciousness, that somehow it can hold within it such delicacy and such grandeur, such inspiration and such terror. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the four elements as part of the Satipatthana practice. For this, for your contemplation, and I'm very happy to invite anyone who has any comments or questions.